This show is for the sales leader who knows they have a pivotal role in driving outstanding sales results. Getting hired or promoted to manage a sales team is a big accomplishment, but you know you have to work hard to become a great sales leader. You are listening to the Divine Comedy of Sales podcast. Here's your host, coach, and advisor to elite sales leaders from around the world, Matt McDarby.
Hello and welcome to the Divine Comedy of Sales podcast. I'm Matt McDarby, veteran seller, leader, coach, and advisor to elite sales leaders all over the world. I'm so excited to have you listening. In our latest season of interview episodes, I'm going to be asking some of the same questions about lessons learned, some of the great challenges that the leaders I'm interviewing have overcome. Who did they learn from? But there's one important question that I'm adding to the mix, and it's essentially, what are the most important parts of your system? And this is my way of bringing systems thinking, which has been a recurring theme of the last several episodes, into our conversations with highly effective and successful sales leaders. Why am I doing that? I'm doing that to help you clarify in your own mind, what are the key elements in your system? What does your sales leader's operating system look like? I'm really excited to have you listening in on these conversations. So I hope you love this season of interviews. Our very next guest is coming up right now. Well, I met our next guest a few years ago as we were both guests on the Sales Game Changers podcast, hosted by Fred Diamond from the Institute for Excellence in Sales. Now, Jason started his sales career like I did in the New York metropolitan area a long time ago. And he eventually moved into sales management. His first role in sales leadership was at Yodel. He then came to the DC area to lead a regional sales team at Living Social. Since then, he served as a leader at CMAP, Green Sky, CallRail, and he presently serves as senior vice president at Moment, a growing player in the fintech industry. Please welcome Jason Rosenblatt. Jason, welcome to the Divine Comedy of Sales.
Thanks, Matt. Appreciate you having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, wonderful. So I'm on the other side of the table from the last time we met because we were both guests on Fred's show.
Yes.
Fun experience.
Yes, absolutely.
So I hope it's okay. I'm going to play host now. I'm going to just dive in. I'm going to ask you some questions so the audience can learn from your experiences.
Yeah.
Okay. So over the last few months and over the last several interview episodes, I've been asking people a question about their system. The reason that I ask the question is over the years, as I've observed really great sales leaders and how they operate, I realized that they have a way of sort of making sense of a pretty complex environment, a complex system.
Yeah.
And so when we talk about systems thinking, I'm really careful because I know our audience, right? We're talking about sales leaders, and I don't want to make this seem like it's an overly academic or clinical view of systems thinking. It's real world. How do you make sense of this all?
Yeah.
Right? And how do you, with all of the various and interconnected parts of the system that makes sales go at Moment or in the other places you've been?
Yeah.
So what are the really key pieces of your system? You've been successful for a long time. Tell us what's in your system.
Yeah. I love this question. And I love systems primarily because early in my leadership career, I feel like I was making a lot of decisions just using my gut. And that can get you so far. I think that you never fully, ignore your gut instincts on things. I think that that just builds over time and develops over time. And the more you learn, the more gray you have in your beard. Or on your head, wherever.
If you still have one.
The females listening in, I hope you don't have gray in your beard. But yeah, I think that especially early in your career, I think they're understanding like how to codify making these decisions is really critical. So you're able to take an objective approach to everything under the umbrella of sales leadership. So for me, I'll talk about one of the most important systems that I've been able to sort of codify over the years. And this started, really at Cvent, actually. I'll tell a quick story on it and then explain what I'm talking about. We had an amazing recruiting team. We had an amazing pipeline of candidates. For those of you not familiar with Cvent, get a ton of candidates early in their career from a lot of the schools in the Nova area. So a lot of the Northern Virginia or the DMV really. And I was leading a sales team. And by the time a candidate would make it to me, that candidate spoke with four other interviewers.
Yeah.
And the feedback was everywhere from a hard yes to a hard no. And then a couple of different levels in between. And then some like anecdotal feedback. And what troubled me so much by the time that I got candidate, which is, by the way, great that I'm being like handed like the feedback and the candidate. So
sure.
Like, I'm not trying to bite the hand that feeds, but it was all very subjective.
Uh-huh.
So I developed this process where I deconstructed what a perfect candidate would look like for whatever the role was, whether it was an entry-level sales role or a more senior sales role. And I broke it down based on different attributes, everything from character to skills, specific skills, you know, as it pertains to sales, like, you know, negotiation and presentation and verbal and written presentation, things like that, everything that you want to break down, came up with a scoring rubric to objectively assess that candidate throughout the interview process on those different skills and then score it, which again, there's some subjectivity to the scoring, but it's on an objective scale. And it allowed me to make much smarter hiring decisions. And it allowed me to objectively look at how well this candidate scored on a grid, on a rating system, on the most important variables. And I've taken that and I've still used that, by the way. And what it has morphed into is also a really, really great candidate experience, because anybody that's listening, raise your hand if you've ever been through an interview experience where like there are multiple rounds and it's the same questions every single round.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the same.
I'm raising my hand.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. me too. It's like that level of redundancy. It's not a great candidate experience. And then ultimately for the hiring manager, you're not getting that objective feedback on whether this is going to be a good candidate or not. So I felt it was the most data-driven way of being able to make hires. So for me, like my system I found to be the most important, the important thing that has led to my success in my career is hiring and hiring through this system.
So what I'm hearing is like, it's critical. You need to have an objective way of evaluating sales candidates. That objective way starts, it sounds also like you got to have some clarity on what the profile looks like for the role.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah. There's a recurring theme when I ask people like you, senior sales leaders have had a lot of success. People/talent, whatever word we want to use, is a very common element. But I think your approach, you said like the closest thing we've got to a data-driven approach, and it is somewhat subjective, but we're trying to squeeze as much of the subjectivity out of the process, right?
Yeah.
What else? So that's huge. So an objective way of evaluating sales candidates, really critical. And I think something people listening can think about and replicate potentially in their environment. What else though? Are there any other and key elements of your system, your approach?
Yeah, I think that one of the lessons that I've learned is that if you make everything a priority, then nothing is a priority. And envisioning your sort of like almost like a pie chart of like how much attention you could give to certain things.
Uh-huh.
And it's a little bit more eye-opening when you start to say, okay, these are the four biggest priorities, but that means I'm only giving 25% of my available time to each of those things. And that doesn't leave time for anything else. So just looking at it as with as much clarity and pragmatism as possible of like, are these all the most important thing that I should be focusing on right now? And am I leaving any room for anything else to squeeze in here? So to summarize, I guess what I'm saying with that is ruthless prioritization. And one of the trends that I've noticed over the last several years that I wish every company did is just the concept of OKRs, like organizational, you know, key objectives and results.
Yeah.
Because it creates that sort of like, this is our focus right now. Anything that falls outside of that, we're not saying it's not important, but it's just not as important as this. So we shouldn't be putting resources into it. We shouldn't be wasting time on it because it doesn't make the cut. And it's almost like if you've ever dealt with a product team, you know, you always want your product team to build that next feature so we can go sell more.
Uh-huh.
And having worked with a lot of different product teams and learned from amazing product leaders, it's like we can't prioritize everything. Like we have to prioritize certain things because this is going to require resources. So what are the most important things and how can you, again, bringing back that word, objectively measure like what the most important things are. Okay. So, so it all comes down to objectively looking at these different metrics or at these different initiatives and saying, okay, is this something that is going to provide a ton of value for us? Are we hemorrhaging revenue because of this problem?
Mm-hmm.
Or do we see a massive upside and we have to act on it now? Or is there going to be a long lead time and we need to start putting effort into this now? Like, and I could provide a ton of specific examples if it helps, but because I'm going through it now. I mean, I just started a new role and everything is a priority.
And this tends to be the time when you're establishing priorities in role for the first time.
Yeah.
Now, then you have other times, you know, maybe I don't know if it's quarterly or if it's even predictable, but other times when you have to revisit those priorities, right? Because something changed.
Yeah.
Right. But that's also an important thing to know to do.
Yeah. So, it's fluid to a certain extent. Like you said, there's got to be a cadence to it, whether it's, you know, weekly, monthly, quarterly, whatever it is. Weekly is a little aggressive. Most organizations are operating off quarterly cadence on these types of things. Although I've seen some organizations do it like once or twice a year.
Yeah. Depends, right? It really depends on the cycles of the business.
Yeah.
You know, for those listening, you can't see something I'm about to show Jason. He said something. I immediately reached to my left. If you could see us on camera, you'd see it. What does it say, Jason?
Ruthless prioritization. I love that. That's incredible.
It's on my cork board. It's right next to me, courtesy of one of my oldest friends in the world, Eric Gillard, who, when he was a director of digital marketing, I believe, he was out at Google.
Yeah.
Visiting Google, and somebody gave him this. He gave him two, actually. I said, give me the other one. So it sits on my cork board. But no, I'm with you.
Yeah, it's so important.
Yeah. And what we're talking about is solving what I describe this to people as the first problem for sales managers.
Yeah.
It's, I don't have enough time to do the really important stuff well.
Yeah.
Next question is, well, what's the important stuff? And then it's like, so what we're hearing from you is know what those top priorities are, get clear about where you have time for them and maybe a few others, and then have a way of sort of establishing those, committing to a rhythm or a cadence where you're addressing those things in an appropriate way. And then be willing to come back and revisit that over time.
Exactly. Right? Yep.
Okay. Yeah, those are big. Objective way of evaluating talent and prioritization, ruthless prioritization, and having a rhythm or a cadence that ensures you're focused on the right stuff.
Yeah.
Any other biggies? I mean, those are big. Any other big ideas in terms of the system? Because I want to get into some other lessons you've learned.
Yeah, I mean, like speaking very specifically about coming into a new organization, there are a lot of challenges that you're going to uncover. And, you know, if anyone has ever been asked with, you know, coming up with a 30, 60, 90, sometimes it's all vanity. Sometimes there's actual like real application to that. But I think the biggest takeaway in the concept of a 30, 60, 90, and I've shared this actually with a lot of friends and colleagues that we're interviewing, and they've used this framework. I didn't come up with it. I don't know where I first heard of it, and it's probably a Frankenstein of ideas, but it's 30, 60, 90 is not as rigid as like the first 30 days, the second 30 days. I view it as like thirds and just looking at whatever that time frame is. And that first third is just observation. It's almost like if you're an attorney, you're doing discovery and it's just investigation and you're asking questions, lots of open-ended questions. You're doing one-on-ones with everybody. You're figuring out who does what, when, where, and why. Like you're just trying to gather information.
Uh-huh.
So that's the first third, is just that observation, gathering information phase. The second third is you start to formulate your opinions and ideas and start to formulate some strategies and based off those observations, and you start to think about, okay, like this is what I think is needs to happen. This is what I think is a high priority. It's all still very fluid.
Sure.
But then that final third is when you start to, that's when the ruthless prioritization kicks in.
Uh-huh.
You know what you're focused on, and then you start executing.
Yeah.
So with a startup, I think that time frame is fast. I could tell you that I did not expect to have the luxury of 30, 60, 90 days to reach that third phase here with Moment. And I'm already, you know, starting. I'm at the end of my fourth week now, entering my fifth week. I'm going to be entering that third phase, which is to start to execute, because I've got a very informed opinions and and on what I need to ruthlessly prioritize.
Yeah. Well, I think that's real, right? And it's not only because there's time pressure sort of at a startup, but it's also, it's a smaller, simpler system.
Well, without a doubt, yeah.
Than a large enterprise or an established business where there's a lot of rules and bad habits and things you have to break first, right? So that makes total sense in terms of like, you know, so it's not 30, 60, 90, maybe it's 14, 28 and 42 or whatever, whatever that is.
That was good. That was really good.
That's pretty, math is not my strength. But
I beg to differ. That was quick thinking. Yeah.
So based on your answer to my question about what's in your system, we can sort of infer that these are things you've learned, right? Things you've learned from others, things you've learned from experience, from success, from failing and learning. What would you say is the most important lesson that you've learned? Maybe that's not sort of rolled up in the things you've already said, but is there another kind of big lesson here that you've learned that you can share?
Yeah, I've learned a lot. I guess the overarching theme is one of the most important lessons is you win or you learn. And, I've talked about this a lot. I think we actually talked about it a little bit in our last conversation, but I'm really big on stoicism and, you know, the obstacle's the path, and just really realizing that in the moment, something may be viewed as like a loss, like we lost this deal or this didn't work. Fill in the blank on whatever this is. But if you view those with a very stoic mindset of, well, no, there's good that came from this. Like we learned something, we won't do it this way again. And now we can go to plan B, or this is just the way it is now. How do we adapt and how do we adapt quickly? Right. So I think that you win or you learn mentality has been transformative for me professionally, for my teams, you know, especially, you know, with different members of my team that I, you know, I view myself as a mentor and a coach and a leader for these individuals. And I, you know, really try to preach that as much as I can. And also personally, in my personal life, I've got two young kids and, you know, they play competitive sports, and trying to instill the you win or you learn mentality with them as well. So that's the biggest lesson. I've got a lot of them, but that's the big one.
Because you literally cannot win everything. You can't, right?
Yeah.
You were a hockey player, right?
Yeah.
And do your little ones play hockey, or what are they playing?
They play soccer.
Okay.
Yeah, travel soccer. So my couple nights a week and every weekend is just dedicated to just being an Uber that doesn't get paid for it.
Yeah,
been it there. Costs me money. So it's the opposite of Uber.
Yeah. How'd you sign up for that duty? No, I've been there. Travel, baseball, football, volleyball, you name it.
Yep. Yeah.
Driving great sales results is hard. Doing it consistently is even harder. There are so many obstacles that can prevent you from becoming the most effective sales leader you can be. Find practical advice you can apply right away by picking up your copy of Matt's book, The Divine Comedy of Sales, at www.divinecomedyofsales.com.
Implied in that, though, is, you know, maybe for, I don't mean younger, but like for people that have learned that lesson yet.
Yeah.
For them, when they lose coach, you got to pick them up.
Yeah.
Because it could be, I think about myself, even my early career, losing a big deal, and I wallowed a little bit.
Yeah.
I was pissed. I would down in the dumps for I don't know how long, but
yeah.
I know I needed somebody to, is that your role, or do they need to sort of learn that, figure it out, I win or I learn, this is on me, or is it like, tell me more about that. Like, how does this play out in your environment?
I think the answer to that is it always comes back to, I think, one of the most overlooked skills, which is hiring and hiring profile. Again, like I keep coming back to that. I mean, if you are hiring for someone who has that, whatever you want to call it, resilience, grit, determination, whatever it is, then I think you have a much higher chance of being able to have someone that can adapt and can actually do the win or learn mindset.
Yeah.
If you don't interview for that and you don't hire for that, then good luck. I don't know what's going to happen. So, and I don't want to come across as like completely like cold hearted and be like, just suck it up and move on. It's not like that. There is absolutely a time and place to be upset like we're humans, right? Okay. We're not AI, we're not robots. Like we're humans and we feel emotions. But at some point, hopefully sooner rather than later, you realize, okay, like let's pick ourselves up, dust ourselves off. What can we learn from this experience? Like,
sure.
There are always takeaways, always. I've been stumped a couple of times, you know, especially in the last year or so. I've spent 2023 consulting. I had my own business between CallRail and now, and working with startup founders. And I've been stumped a couple of times where we lost a deal and it went completely sideways. But ultimately, there's always something to extract from that experience. Like, sure. Do you change your sales qualification methodology? Do we change our pitch? Do we change our pricing? Do we change? There's so many things that you can extract from that. It's all relative. Like every situation is different. But if you view every single one of those experiences as a learning opportunity, that's how you can evolve like very fast.
Sure.
Not to mention the benefits of just like mindset, right? Like, if you can trick yourself into believing, and it is, it's a hack, right? Like it's a mental hack. If you can trick yourself into believing, like I never lose, I only learn. That's right. Crazy.
Right.
That's an elite mindset.
Sure.
That's really hard to do.
And it's required. Sometimes I end up inadvertently sort of knocking other functions or disciplines like finance or.
You will never hear me say that on a podcast.
No, I know that. I know, but I can say it.
I love finance. Yeah.
I do too. They approve my POs and, you know.
Yeah.
but the thing that's unique about selling the function and the discipline is that we really can't, we have to move on. We have to learn and get better every day. Like I said, I'm not a finance guy. I'm not an accountant. But I imagine if I'm having a really bad day, I can still fill in the ledger.
Yeah. Yeah.
But if I feel like I just got kicked in the teeth and I'm doubting myself, it affects my confidence. That might come out in the very next presentation I make or the conversation I have with a totally different customer, which
yeah.
is absolute no-go. Can't happen, right?
Yeah.
That's why this mentality you're talking about is so important.
Yeah. I had to learn that actually at Yodel when, you know, if you've got back-to-back demos. And I was an individual contributor when I first started there. I moved into leadership, but I started off as an account exec and we were doing full cycle sales and we were selling, you know, at the time, this is 2008. So there were still phone books in 2008.
And I remember.
It was fun. You were calling these businesses, small businesses, and saying like, hey, do you have a website? And a lot of them would be like, no, what's that?
It was
crazy. Yeah. It was only 15, 16 years ago. But a lot of them had websites, but weren't promoting the website, et cetera. So it was full cycle sales and it was very transactional. Like you were trying to close on the demo. And there were days where I had just stacked demos, like back to back to back to back to back, anywhere from 30 minutes to 45 minutes. And you're asking for the credit card information on the call.
Uh-huh.
And if it's, you know, if you get a couple of no's in a row and you start to just like go into this spiral,
sure.
Like you're done. You're screwed. Like the prospects feel you pressing. They feel they could sense it. I know they do because I've sensed it being on this side of it. So
sure.
you've got to be able to have that elite mindset. And I think that's really what separates a lot of the great from the rest.
Yeah.
That elite mindset of like, it already happened. Like there's nothing you can do about it. Like this is focus on this right now.
Yeah.
So yeah. No, easier said than done, but.
Well, but again, I think it's. Sorry to interrupt. I think it's an important reminder, right? For leaders listening here, maybe it's been a little while since you carried a bag.
Yeah.
And you forget the emotion of the job, right? As an individual contributor, just let's not forget that, what that feels like and how important it is to make sure that, because what you're describing is an expectation, you win or you learn, right?
Yeah.
We're going to lose, meaning we are going to lose. We must learn from that and get a little better, right?
Yeah.
But what it also means is, since that's the expectation, as a leader, I can't act differently when we learn.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, when we lose and we have to learn, right? I can't come down on people if I've got this very sort of positive mindset about it.
Yeah.
I've got to find a way to strike a balance here, which is tough.
Well, you brought up a really interesting point that I think is critical, and it applies to everything that we're talking about here, is like, don't forget what it was like when you were carrying a bag, if you're in a leadership role, and also don't be too far removed because things have evolved a lot. Like things have changed a lot.
Oh, yeah.
So The last time I carried a bag was 15 years ago, 16 years ago. Uh-huh. But the last time I did a demo was always. Like, I'm always still, because I can't, a couple of things. One, I can't provide like real like constructive feedback if I don't fully understand what is happening with mm-hmm. prospects and my team. But I can't justify like them wanting to listen to me or take that feedback if they're like, you don't yeah. know what you're talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah.
Like,
thanks, so, boss.
Yeah, exactly. Be like, all right, thanks. I'm going to go back to doing it my way now. So yeah. And it just like the goodwill it generates, the trust it generates is unbelievable. And I think a lot of sales leaders ignore that.
Yeah.
They either think they're too good for it or they just don't even think about it. So it's not even malicious. They just don't think about it. So I would encourage everybody who's listening right now, like get down on their level as much as you can and show them how to do it. And even if you get your teeth kicked in, like that's also okay. Right.
Learn.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
Let's practice what we preach, right? Yeah. Let's learn. Okay, good. All right. So you're a thoughtful guy. You've given the role a lot of thought, as evidenced by your answers, and which to me suggests you love it.
I love it.
To some degree, right?
I love it.
What do you love most?
Yeah. So as I mentioned, I spent the last year consulting. I was, working with startup founders, and I really enjoyed helping different businesses out. It was different verticals, and helping these founders that were just building from scratch and really starting to figure everything out. The main thing that was missing this past year, and it got to a point where it forced me to start, to pick my head up and see what was out there.
Okay.
I miss being on a team. I miss leading a team. I miss the mentorship and the gratification that I got out of developing people on my team and getting them to that next level. I know this might sound, it may come across as a little bit cheesy, but I sort of had this epiphany a few years ago, and I don't know if it was during COVID where everybody was sort of having these existential crises on a daily basis. But I started to think, I'm a father of two. What's the impact? What's my legacy? What am I going to do in this? Like, how am I going to be remembered in this world? I'm not finding any cures for cancer. I'm not an engineer. I'm not building these things or inventing these things, right? And then I started to think about all the lives that I've positively impacted through my leadership roles, whether it's like hiring somebody, developing them, getting them to like helping them earn a living and sometimes very like good livings.
Sure.
They move up in their career, and then beyond that, like, am I a reference for them on another call? Am I giving them guidance? Am I mentoring them after the fact? And I've touched at this point hundreds of lives, but like, on a close scale, like dozens and dozens of people that I look at, it's almost like a coaching tree. That is really profound. And I had to step back and like think about it. And then it gave me like this refound like motivation and inspiration for what I do. So like to answer your question, for me, it's like being on that team and being able to develop people and give them that opportunity.
Yes,
I joke with people sometimes about like quota attainment, W-2 and this metric and that. And usually I'm, just tell me about what you've been able to achieve. And I hit them with, that's great. None of this is going on your gravestone.
Yeah.
None of it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And the real legacy is clearly your family, your children, but also the people whose lives you touch by developing them and helping them to win and achieve the things that matter to them.
Yep.
Right. So interesting also, Jason, that I've heard very similar answers from other very successful senior sales leaders that the thing they love most is developing others, helping people win, being a part of their growth.
Yeah.
Low self-orientation, which may be a surprise to people who don't really understand how a great sales leader operates. They think that's sort of this big ego thing, this big ego person sort of, and in the end, the best people who do the job most effectively have a very low self-orientation and are very much focused on others' success more than their
own. Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, if that weren't the case, I would probably be an individual contributor closing big deals or something.
Sure.
But it has never been about me.
Yeah.
And I've never chased the money. The money has come because I've cared about my team and my people and it happened as a result. Like, it has never been the primary focus. If that was the case, I would be an individual contributor.
Right.
And that's not the path that I took. So I'm not, that's not to say it's right or wrong. It's just that's
I understand.
Path that I took. So
yeah. And it's worked out.
Yeah.
All right. I can only keep you for a couple more minutes here. Okay. So I'm going to ask you one open, purposely vague question I ask everybody at the end of these conversations, which is, hey, Jason, what else? What else do we need to know? What else do you want to share with us in the time we have?
Yeah. This last year was really interesting for me because I realized, so I worked with a lot of different founders, and there's something really special about a founder of a company, someone that is starting a company, they're going out and raising money, and they have that bravery and that passion and then that creativity and that idea to go do something and then start something. And it's really, really, really hard to do. Uh-huh. And I did it as a solopreneur, so I'm not even trying to put myself in the same category as someone that has other lives and livelihoods.
Sure.
Responsibility on every decision that they make. So I felt the stress, the anxiety, the pressure through my clients every day. And I will say that the people that are successful have a good understanding, a good foundational understanding of sales, and like understand whether they were in sales or were involved in some capacity with sales, like maybe like customer success or account management or, you know, even product, and they were close to sales or sales engineers somehow. I've seen some unbelievable success with those founders that have a background in sales because they were able to teach themselves the more technical skills. They were able to find a technical founder. Uh-huh. And when you're building a company, the reason I got into sales in the first place, by the way, I, you know, graduated from college, didn't know what I was going to do, like a lot of other people. And this is back in 2004. And I got a job at Enterprise Rent a Car right out of college.
Yeah, yep.
Management training program. A lot of jokes about that from, you know, the movie Step Brothers. you know, and then when I sort of hit a breaking point there and thought maybe like getting my MBA is the right move, or maybe going and getting, you know, to getting my JD and becoming a lawyer is the right move. And then I realized I didn't really like school very much. So that would be probably miserable. Uh-huh. And my dad actually gave me this piece of feedback, and he's like, everybody is in sales in some way, shape, or form. Uh-huh. And through my dad, actually found out about Yodel. He had a small business in South Florida, and he became a client of theirs, hit it off with their account executive. Their account executive and I spoke because my dad was like, hey, my son is also in New York. He's trying to figure out what the hell he's going to do with his life.
Yeah.
And he and I hit it off. And then I met the founders and I hit it off with them, and the rest is history. But I got into it because I wanted to learn how to sell. I knew it would be a valuable skill set at some point. I didn't know I would start a career in sales or sales leadership. I had no idea where it was going to go at the time, but through that effort and like and that trajectory, I've built a career that I'm very proud of. And I, like I said, I've been able to influence a lot of people's lives in a positive way, and I've been able to build a, you know, a nice career here, and I'm still going. But I would encourage everybody at some point to kind of get out of their comfort zone and realize that there are things that happen when you're out of your comfort zone. Like there's a lot of that growth that happens, the personal development, professional development that happens when you get out of your comfort zone. And it's amazing like what we're capable of doing. Like what's the worst that happens? Again, it goes back to you win or you learn.
Sure.
So like, so maybe it's usually like, holy crap, I found this new amazing skill, and, or I'm really, I like this a lot. I'm gonna lean into this even more. Or you at least can say, I don't think I like this, but at least I know now.
I tried.
I tried, right? So yeah. I think the overarching theme there is just get out of your comfort zone and see what you're capable of and push yourself a little bit.
Yeah. And credit to your dad for making the connection that launches a career, right? What's his name?
Sergio Rosenblatt.
Sergio Rosenblatt. Thank you, Sergio.
Thank you,
your contributions. Wonderful. Well, Jason, we're out of time. I'm going to take a moment here in just a few seconds to kind of ponder some things that you shared, offer a summary for a few minutes for our audience, and challenge them to think about how can you apply some of the lessons and the things we've heard from Jason to your role. Before I do that, thank you very much. This was wonderful. I really enjoyed having you join the show.
Thank you, Matt. Thanks for having me. This was a blast.
All right. Let me get to that summary. I want to thank Jason again for joining us on the show. I knew that he'd have some real gems to share with us. And so
I'll play back a few of the things that he said in summary, and then let's think about how they apply to you on your journey. One of the things that he said was early in his career, he relied on instinct. And he said, now I understand that taking an objective approach to making decisions is really the right way to go about it. The reason I'm zeroed in on that is I think that's a really simple way of describing a kind of a journey that we all go through as we mature in the role as a sales manager. That in the early days, right, we really trust our own instincts and we really don't slow things down to think critically, diagnose the situation, and kind of take a step or two back from it to be able to determine, well, what is the real problem we're trying to solve here, for example? Or what's another way we could be going about pursuing this opportunity that may be different from what I've done in the past, right? So it requires a fair amount of maturity and humility to think that way and to say that out loud as a leader. And that's exactly how Jason described his journey. That resonated with me. I wonder if you think about your own experience and where you are in your current development, is there more that you can do to take an objective approach to making decisions in your business? I asked Jason about what are the key elements in his system. He, again, talked about objectivity. He said, I need an objective way of evaluating sales candidates. So he's talking about talent, and have a really clear way of evaluating them and having essentially a scoring rubric, knowing what's most important in the candidates that we're looking for and having a way to objectively measure the people that we meet to figure out if they're a fit. I thought that's really smart. And again, something that I think all of us can apply to the process, that very challenging process of hiring the right people, right? Know how you're going to evaluate people, have objective criteria that you can use to essentially measure and score candidates that you meet. He also said you really have to know your top priorities and get clear about where you have time for them. That resonates with me because for the last many years, I've been advocating for having an operating rhythm or cadence that includes time for your most important priorities. The question for you to think about is today, what are my most important priorities? Jason says that's a key part of his system. I'm validating that and say, yep, that's what I see the best leaders doing. And then finally, I love his attitude, Jason's attitude about the job. He says, you win or you learn. I know we've heard that before, but you know, we can't win every deal. We can't win or succeed with every move that we make. And the most we can hope for when we don't win or we don't succeed is that we learn something. What have you learned today? What did you learn last week? What did you learn this past quarter? I'm sure you learned things from when you won, from when you succeeded. There are things you want to repeat. But are there lessons that you've learned where you didn't win? What are the things that you will stop doing? Or what are the things that you will change to make sure that the next time you're faced in a similar circumstance, you'll have a better approach, right? And you will win. So we win or we learn. So I want to thank Jason once again. Great leader, great guest. So glad he was able to join us. And I want you to think about how some of the key lessons he's learned apply to your reality. In our next episode, we are going across the pond, virtually, of course, to speak with another great leader and coach. He spends as much time as I do thinking about coaching and sales leadership. I think you're going to love that episode. It was a great conversation. And I want to invite you to listen in on that conversation. I hope you love it. Until then, this is Matt McDarby, author and host of the Divine Comedy of Sales podcast. Thank you very much for listening. Bye-bye for now.